This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University.
In this edition of the Legislative Gazette, we'll explore reaction to Governor Cuomo's decision to veto legislation that would have made corporate takeovers more difficult. Also, a report from pollster Lee Merengon on the upcoming run for U.S. Senate. Earlier this year, the legislature passed and Governor Cuomo signed a bill continuing the practice of barring the press and public from party conferences, those meetings during which the fate of most legislation is actually decided. Despite that, the issue hasn't died away, and Common Cause this week launched a drive to overturn that law. Here's more from Marianne Snell.
Coordinators of the New York State Common Cause and the League of Women Voters announced the kickoff of a combined statewide campaign to urge the repeal of the recent May 31st legislation in Albany, which amends the open meetings law and limits public participation in governmental meetings.
Beginning today, 27,000 members of New York State Common Cause, working with their Partners for Good Government in the League of Women Voters, will begin a statewide campaign urging local county legislatures, town boards, village councils, city governments throughout the state to do two things. First, to adopt a resolution declaring that they will not avail themselves of this newly created loophole in the open meetings law. Second, memorializing the state legislature to repeal this loophole or black hole, if you will, in the open meetings law. Now, perhaps it goes too far to say that Friday, May 31st was a day that will live in infamy, but quite frankly, all of us in Common Cause, in the League of Women Voters, and the cause of good government in general were shocked by the actions taken here in Albany on May 30th and May 31st. There can be room for debate about the merits of the open meeting law and the specific interpretation of the political caucus exemption. But there can be no excuse whatsoever for the irresponsible behavior of the legislature and the governor in dealing with this question. The law itself is one that's quite shocking to all of us in good government. But equally disturbing to the League of Women Voters and Common Cause is the manner in which this was adopted. As you here in Albany know, legislation adopted in committee was mysteriously amended, passed by both houses, transferred to the governor's office, and signed into law before any of us had a chance to study the legislation and provide meaningful critique.
Timothy Lavallo is the chairman of the New York State Common Cause, which together with the League of Women Voters has instigated a statewide campaign to urge the state legislature to reestablish an open meetings policy which would restore public access to all governmental meetings and deliberation. This is Marianne Snell.
Sometime in the near future, the legislature may be asked to exert some muscle or provide more money or both in an effort to improve the system for tracking what hazardous chemicals are discharged into the waterways of New York State. A recent study by the environmental group Inform turned up some problems in the data-keeping system. The man who performed the study, Dr. Stephen Roman, talked with Bill Gralty.
The information was, in some cases, difficult to obtain from the regulatory agencies. It's not all in one place. We had to travel to not only Albany, to the DEC, the Department of Environmental Conservation Central Office, but to each of the five regional offices more than one time in order to obtain all of the forms and information documents that we were trying to gather. Once we got these documents, if they were indeed available, there was a great deal of difficulty in some cases trying to interpret what types of discharges were occurring from these specific plants. The information isn't put together in a consistent and readily definable fashion that makes it easy to determine how much is being released over time. There are a great many of errors in the data that it's compiled. There's inconsistencies in how this data is compiled, and there are just plain omissions in some of the forms. So it becomes very difficult to make these determinations.
Would this be an area that could be improved without too much trouble, do you think?
One of the suggestions that we are trying to put forth is that if regulatory agencies do indeed want to do what they say they want to do, which is decrease the amount of these toxic chemicals going into the Hudson and to get a better picture of how much is actually being released to the river, they need to reevaluate the types of information that they're gathering, how they deal with this data once they have it in-house, and then how they evaluate it in order to determine how much is being released to the environment.
I imagine with the situation the way it is, it would be somewhat difficult to do an accurate and fairly up-to-date monitoring on the part of, say, the DEC or another state agency.
I couldn't respond to that simply because we don't know exactly what the protocol is that the DEC would put forth in order to do this. We know that that for the sampling that's done from the dischargers, it's not done always in a consistent fashion.
Is this the kind of thing that it might take a little legislative pressure to force them into?
There have been it's actually a question that is a political question because there have been comments made by Commissioner Henry Williams of the DEC saying that they don't need more money. They can do more with less. What we're suggesting may mean that there needs to be a reevaluation of how this money is allocated. It may mean that they need to have more money allocated to do the job better. There's obviously these problems with the database, that there's with these errors, inconsistencies, and omissions. It may point to the fact that the questions need to be answered as far as how this money is being used. Is it being used effectively? Are they getting more information for the money that's being spent? So it does come down in some cases to a political question, and that's something that Inform obviously can't answer. But we hope that this report will make it possible for legislators, citizens, regulators, and just anyone that's concerned about the Hudson River and toxic pollution problems in the Hudson to look closely at how this money is being spent and maybe have more money allocated or have better systems developed to gather this information and make sense out of it.
Dr. Stephen Roman of Inform with Bill Graldi. Joining us now is Dr. Lee Marengoff, director of the highly respected Marist College Institute for Public Opinion.
There will be another statewide election in 1986, however, that should prove to be much more competitive. It is the race that should occupy the attention of pollsters, politicians, media, and the public as well, namely the expected re-election campaign of New York's junior senator, Al D'Amato. Narrowly victorious in 1980 over Elizabeth Holtzman, D'Amato has enjoyed a growing visibility in New York state politics, particularly in the New York City television market. D'Amato was active in fostering the fortunes of Ronald Reagan in 1984 and has worked hard to establish his reputation as a fighter for New York State in Washington. Some political analysts point to D'Amato's extensive media exposure, his conservative voting record in the state which Ronald Reagan carried, and his image as factors making D'Amato's reelection bid a strong possibility. Other analysts point to D'Amato's breaking with President Reagan on some key domestic policy legislation, like Social Security and the deductibility component of Reagan's tax reform proposal, as being evidence of a sense on D'Amato's part that the reelection campaign will ultimately be hotly contested. During the past several years, data collected by the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion on Senator D'Amato reveal an interesting pattern. Overall, 48% of the state's voters gave D'Amato positive scores on his job performance. 35% gave D'Amato negative marks, and a full 17% were either unsure or do not have an opinion on him. This represents a mixed picture. Clearly, D'Amato is nowhere near as popular, either President Reagan or Governor Cuomo in New York State. His scores are behind, although close, to those received by Senator Moynihan. It is his don't knows and his no opinions that are very high. To D'Amato's credit, his positive rating has improved by about 5 points in the past year. In looking more closely at the figures, D'Amato's showing in the suburbs, 57%, his home area and one in which Republicans have scored well electorally, is somewhat low. His numbers in New York City, 55%, an area usually for Democratic strongholds, is surprisingly high at this point. Upstate, a Republican stronghold, D'Amato's ratings are very unusual. His 38% approval rating is very low, and this is because many failed to express an opinion on his performance. Whether this reflects political vulnerability or merely a lack of familiarity outside of the New York City media market remains to be seen. Assuming D'Amato's pollsters are examining similar data, one should expect an effort this fall and winter on D'Amato's part to tighten up his image upstate prior to launching his reelection campaign. On the Democratic side, we expect several candidates to express interest in trying to win this seat in 1986, including Elizabeth Holtzman, Geraldine Ferraro. Also, a run by State's Attorney General Robert Abrams should not be discounted. More on this as the political season heats up next year. In the meantime, for the Legislative Gazette, this is Lee Merengoff at the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion in Poughkeepsie.
This bill is ineffective. This bill would produce a lot of fees for a lot of lawyers, a lot of litigation.
With those words, Governor Cuomo this week vetoed legislation which would have severely restricted the chances of a New York-based company becoming the victim of an unfriendly corporate takeover. The legislation came to be known as the CBS or Ted Turner bill because it came to light during the time Ted Turner was actively trying to gain control of CBS. In vetoing the bill, Governor Cuomo commented that, despite the lopsided nature of its legislative victory, it had few friends but many enemies. One friend, though, was the New York State Business Council. Its president is Raymond Schuler. Ray Schuler, you were on the other side on this one. The governor has now vetoed the corporate takeover bill. First, tell us a little about what that bill would have done.
Well, Alan, in our view, it would have been an important piece of legislation for our state, first of all, for our communities. One of the things that's been devastating to New York is the impact of takeovers and the loss of jobs that have occurred, the loss of tax base. To get some understanding of that, you need a disclosure law. Before a company can move in and take over, they should be made to publicly disclose. We had a law on our books that required that. In another state, a similar law was found unconstitutional. This legislation would have corrected that. And Bob Abrams, the Attorney General of New York State, drafted that legislation to ensure it would meet the test of constitutionality. So that, you know, very quickly said, that law would have done a lot for the communities of our state, for the workforce in our state, and it would have said to the business leaders in New York State that this is a good place to put your corporation, to put your headquarters, and a good place to do business.
Sort of like a Delaware.
Yeah, well, Delaware has become a haven, as you know, for corporate headquarters, and I don't like to quote other people, but Speaker Fink very early on recognized the importance of this legislation when he said, what's wrong with New York becoming a haven for corporations?
So, let's go on. You mentioned Bobby Abrams. The governor, in his press conference announcing his veto, said that Bobby Abrams thought that this very piece of legislation was unconstitutional. What do you think?
Well, it's unfortunate the governor didn't read Bob Abrams' 14-page legal brief on this legislation, because in conclusion and in summary, he said that, yes, there will be constitutional questions. You settle those in a court. And we were very careful in this legislation to have a thing known as a severability clause, so that if some part were to be found bad, you wouldn't lose the whole legislation. And what we're trying to impress upon the governor, right now, New York State's been left bare. We're an open target for every Carl Icahn, T. Boone Pickens in the country that wants to come in here, knock off our corporations, decimate them, shut them down, close them off, put people out of work. By that veto, we don't have that protection in New York anymore. We could have had it, even if there were some questions. We could have settled those 30 days from now, 40 days from now, 50 days from now, while we had the protection in the meantime. The Abrams memorandum very clearly says that this legislation is an improvement on the existing law, and that while there may be some tests in it, he did not find it to be unconstitutional.
One of the problems constitutionally that has been raised with this is that what is the state of New York doing getting involved in this kind of thing when this is really a federal question, a question of a commerce clause, that a state shouldn't be making these rules, that the federal government should be regulating this. What do you think about that?
Oh, that's the classic hide behind the feds issue. And I say, you know, I just hogwash, because a company, to become incorporated, must incorporate within the laws of a state. There is no national law that provides for incorporation. Now, the governor knows that, and the attorney general knows that, and the opponents of the legislation and the proponents know that businesses incorporate state by state. It is required by the state to set statute for the governance of a corporation, and that's what we're talking about here in New York.
This bill was known as the Ted Turner bill. Was that unfortunate from your perspective?
Oh, it really was, Alan, because I suppose if we ever sit down and really do a good academic analysis of this legislation, no one in this state was ever opposed to this kind of legislation. The Turner forces, at the time they're trying to take over CBS, immediately labeled this as anti-Turner, and that seemed to capture everyone's imagination that it was a TBS or CBS bill. And you know, the whole record of when we first discussed the specific legislation with the governor last December at our summit meeting with him, there was no Turner offer to take over CBS. When the legislature opened in January and the sponsors started working, there was no offer. In February and March, when the legislation was printed, there was no offer, but it still got labeled that this was to stop Ted Turner. Well, it's interesting. Maybe it did stop him. He's not now taking over CBS. He's got another target. But it had nothing to do with Ted Turner. And it was unfortunate, and I think if we ever look back at the history of this, of the evolving bits of this legislation, whoever cleverly labeled it as that, I think did great damage to the hopes of that legislation being signed into law in New York for the protection of share owners and communities.
Not to digress, but is that a problem with our media, that they saw that as an opportunity to clarify what this bill did by attaching it to one case and therefore may have ruined it for a lot more?
Well, Alan, I wouldn't sit here and be on your show and attack media. No, I don't. I think, in reality, you know, you have to simplify issues for public understanding of them, and the Turner issue was a good way to show what it would or wouldn't do. But it really wasn't aimed at him. I'm not even too sure that the way the law was drawn that it would have even have applied to him. The reality being, though, that in our media works, you have to simplify things.
Is it conceivable the bill would have passed if Ted Turner had not been involved? In other words, it might have gone sailing through without Ted Turner's issue complicating this?
Well, it passed overwhelmingly in the legislature, and I don't think the Turner issue meant anything in the vote in the legislature. I don't, you know, it didn't start aimed at him, and it didn't pass either aimed at him or for CBS. I don't think it really played a significant role there.
There are those who feel, however, that it would have been treated in a more business-like, routine fashion if the Ted Turner thing had not sensationalized it.
I think you're probably correct in that. You're a good analyst of public issues, and I think you're probably right. I think what it did is it put a wrong focus at the wrong time on the legislation, because if you read the legislation in detail, if you know what the objectives were that were set out in the original legislative arguments, clearly this legislation met those tests.
Now, the governor did an interesting thing in his press conference yesterday in critiquing you and your organization. He said he had heard from other members of your organization who did not agree with you. That's sort of a divide and conquer thing. Some people might think that's nasty.
Well, the governor has the right to say what he feels like saying on issues like that. The reality is that an overwhelming number of our membership, an overwhelming consensus, supported this legislation. I have to say there were a handful of the 3,900 member firms who did not. They happened to all be Wall Street firms or Wall Street connected. And unfortunately, we got into a classic situation of Wall Street versus Main Street. And in this instance, it looks like the Wall Street crowd had their way with the governor.
That's very interesting because, as you know, there's a significant biographical body of knowledge, if you want to put it that way, around here, which says that Governor Cuomo doesn't like Wall Street, that he has been reacting adversely to them in a number of ways, and which can be demonstrated. Do you think in this case he was playing to them?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I could characterize it that way. In this instance, when he says that he heard from other businesses, I would only say that the overwhelming number of businesses that he heard from in opposition to the legislation were investment banker-type firms, the Wall Street groups and crowds and so on, not businesses who employ manufacturing people, service sector people, and so on. I say, as a matter of fact, the few companies of ours very active with us who had no interest in the bill really took sort of a middle ground position that they felt it would be good for the economy of New York State, but they didn't themselves have a direct interest in it, but they did from their suppliers, material people who support them.
So what's the prognosis? You think that you'll work together and you think there'll be a bill this year?
2 years ago, when the governor said we weren't ready to do a personal income tax cut, we didn't give up then and we kept working, and we now have one in New York State. I don't give up on issues that are important for the business community, its workforce, its employees in New York. We will continue to work until we have a perfected piece of legislation that becomes the laws of the state of New York.
Here's the $50,000 question. Why did he veto the bill?
I have yet to find anyone who's been able to give me that answer. The message doesn't tell us. I sat long before the veto came out with his staff people. As a matter of fact, the morning of the veto, we spent 2 hours with the secretary to the governor, with the counsel to the governor, and with his economic development director, and none of them could give me a specific reason as to why the governor was vetoing the bill.
There's a body of thought out here who thinks that he vetoed the bill because the Assembly and Senate went ahead and passed it without really including him in the business community, without really including him in on the negotiations. One lobbyist I spoke with, a labor lobbyist, said specifically to me that he had been purposely excluded and that the expectation was that he'd go along. What do you think about that? In other words, you might have had an angry governor who says, if you're going to design legislation, make sure I'm in on it, and it may have been that kind of peak.
Oh, I don't think the governor of our state makes decisions on that basis. That would surprise me. As a matter of fact, I don't believe the governor was out of it at all. I think he was aware of it in December when he met with us. He was furnished copies of it, and I have written comments back to us on the draft legislation from members of his administration. Maybe not him directly personally, but he had later in March received copies of the legislation. If he had some input, he had March, April, May, June, into July to make whatever input he had. And I'm sure that in the legislative process on his end of the table, he probably had some discussions with the leaders. I don't think the governor would have acted in a fit of pique because he wasn't involved. And besides, he had extra couple of weeks even after the legislation came to him to get over any concern he may have had about that. I just think that in his view, he wasn't all the way there yet. I think he's 85% there on this legislation. And our mission and job over the next couple of weeks is to get him the rest of the way.
Do you see this as a major defeat for the Business Council?
Oh, hardly. When I can say to you that in two houses there are 3 votes against the legislation, and when it was lobbied by some of the most expensive, high-powered, expensive lobbyists in this state who flew in here and put on one of the most assiduous campaigns that we have seen in Albany in a very long time, and it still passed, and that the governor had to ask the legislature to give him at least 2 more weeks to consider what he should do with this legislation. And then in turn, when they will invite me in before the decision and say, now look, how will we come together to make sure that we get a bill? Yesterday, and I may be off on our days now because the days sort of run together in Albany, but the morning of the legislation, a personal commitment was made to me by the secretary to the governor and the counsel to the governor's economic director that we will have a piece of legislation ready for you to look at, Ray, in 30 days. Wow. So it's 30 days and counting.
Raymond Schuler, president of the State Business Council. So Governor Cuomo has gone and done it. He's vetoed the corporate takeover, or Ted Turner bill, which would have made it tougher for the T. Boone Pickens types to acquire corporations in unfriendly takeovers. So all Albany is ablaze in discussions of why the governor did it. Here are some of the possible answers. 1, the governor's answer. He says that he did it on constitutional grounds. He said that the controller and the attorney general refused to tell him that the bill was constitutional. He says that the bill would have been challenged in court, and that while he didn't like green mail, and that while he was sympathetic, he would still veto the bill. According to the governor, there was not politics here, but just reading the bill and deciding on the merits. Other speculation says the governor is wrong. So, to the Ted Turner answer, this line of reasoning suggests that the one thing that intrigued the governor about the bill was the opportunity to help CBS, the great national network, from being taken over by Ted Turner. This reasoning continues that when a federal court knocked Turner out of the running in his efforts to take over CBS, that Cuomo really wasn't that interested in helping the business community. And why not? That's reason number three. In this case, the scuttlebutt all over Albany is that the business community chose to play hardball with the legislature without dealing the governor in. In other words, they took this bill directly to the Assembly and the Senate and didn't bother to do more than keep the governor informed. So let me ask you, if you were the governor, would you like that? And indeed, business insiders suggest that the impression that the governor was excluded from this part of the process may have been complicated by the fact that the governor thought that they, the business community and the Assembly and the Senate, were playing footsie earlier in earlier tax proposals, again leaving the governor as the odd man out. If you read the corporate takeover veto carefully, the governor makes it clear that he is willing to draft a new bill achieving the same purposes, but this time with Mario Cuomo sitting at the head of the table. And finally, four, the presidential answer. This reasoning goes that the governor has been suspect by groups like the Wall Street Journal and the like for years. They didn't like this corporate takeover bill at all, considering it protectionist and parochial from a New York point of view. If Cuomo was a presidential candidate, his showing them that he was sympathetic to a national view like a good dose of chicken soup couldn't hurt. And in fact, the day after the veto, the Wall Street Journal gave him an editorial send-off you wouldn't believe, a big pat on the back. So there you are. There are just a few of the possible explanations of why Mario Cuomo vetoed the corporate takeover bill. You pick them and you choose them. That's our show for this week. Join us again next week for another look at state government and politics. Bill Gualty edits and produces this program. This week he really had to edit it. We had help from Mary Ann Snell. Please address comments and questions to us at WAMC, Box 13,000, Albany, New York, 12212. I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University of New York College at New Paltz.